Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Well, having thought the great age of archaeological discovery in Egypt ended sometime last century with discoveries like the tomb of Tutankhamun, I was a little bit surprised to see that 300 previously undiscovered mummies and some significant other artworks and artifacts have actually turned up in Egypt. That's good news for Egypt at a time of declining tourism and indeed for those devoted to the study of ancient Egypt, people like Dr. Karen Sawada, Honorary Associate, Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Stephen.
Welcome to Open House. I know you've been on the program before, but welcome to the new iteration.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. So are these new antiquities that have turned up, are they genuine?
Well, yes, indeed they are. These are excavations that are conducted by the Cairo University and the Egyptian Antiquities Authority, who conduct a lot of archaeological work in Egypt alongside foreign missions. There's a great number of foreign missions in Egypt. And look, I've been following these discoveries very closely, as I always do. And look, they're very exciting, and certainly all of them are genuine, including the big statue that was found in Cairo, a Cairo suburb, quite recently.
In a suburb of Cairo?
Yes, yes. Well, it got a great deal of global media. It was a colossal statue which was found in the mud during excavations for a development. And it actually belongs to a major temple, which was nearby. There's not very much of it left now. And this colossal statue was literally found in the mud as the workmen were digging the foundations for a new building. So, these things are discovered often quite by accident. It really, and not just in Egypt. I mean, in any place where there's ancient remains, whether it be Britain or France, Israel, Jordan, often such discoveries are made quite accidentally while the government or developers are putting in a new road or a building.
Hmm. Something that I've tried to imagine and in you sort of bring to mind as I've been in places like, for instance, Jerusalem and elsewhere throughout the Middle East where I've travelled a little bit. I'm not in Egypt, though, unfortunately. I've tried to imagine how it is that generation after generation, one town, one city, one village, whatever, is built on top of another. Can you describe to us how that happens? Because it might then help me to visualise how it is that you can still dig down and find stuff that's been there for centuries.
Sure. Well, you need to understand that towns are put in a particular location for a particular reason. So it might be that there is a perennial water source, it's near a river, it's in an optimal location on an east-west or north-south trade route, or on a mountain pass. So people build cities for because the location is optimizes economic or agricultural or living standards. So these locations, the optimization of these locations really don't change. I mean, Sydney is a great example of that. So the first fleet turns up, they looked at Botany Bay, shook their heads and thought, nah, went a bit further up the coast and found a wonderful location in one of the best deep water harbours in the world. And so, the rest is history, as they say. And look, the same is true in ancient times. So what happens is that a settlement is started for a good reason, usually around food production or communication routes or defensive positions, and then over time the site it grows, it's augmented by new buildings. The old buildings are destroyed as people build new walls or new houses or a palace is built. Mm. And so over time the cities just grow in size, and the layers upon layer upon layer upon layer grow with it. So sometimes these towns can be, or these cities can be quite significant. And Jericho, we know obviously from the Bible, was actually first inhabited way back around 10,000 BC. So, and over time, again, because it's an oasis with a perennial water source, it's been a magnet for human occupation.
Yeah.
So the same is true of Egypt, although its landscape is quite different, of course.
Yes.
But what we also have in Egypt that we often don't have so much of in other places is, of course, these extraordinary remains, these human remains preserved in the desert by way of the cemetery. So as a result, we have not just the towns, the temples, the stone temples, but we have this enormously well-preserved series of tombs right up and down Egypt which as a result of the desert climate, which has preserved these human remains. So it's really the main reason why we've got so many mummies, why we've got so many inscribed papyri, why we've got so many fragments of the Bible, because many of our fragments of the New Testament in particular actually come from early Christian settlements in the desert where the scribes were copying the Bible. So these fragments, 2,000 years old, are preserved because of the dry desert climate.
Mm. Well, I was wandering around the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York recently, and I'm, what a privilege to be there. They've got a very extensive Egypt display right at the moment. But I was trying to place myself in the period of Moses. What do we know from ancient Egyptian findings about the time that corresponded with Moses' time? And indeed, do we have evidence of the Exodus?
Well, it's a very, very thorny question, the evidence of the Exodus. Just on the question of Moses' time, it's a problematic period because we don't exactly know, as scholars, where to place the Exodus. So there's a series of three theories, usually placed around the middle of the second millennium BC, so sort of around 1550 BC is one time, 1550, middle of the second millennium, and then there's a couple of other points at which one could line up the biblical evidence with the Egyptian historical evidence. So we're just not entirely certain where you would actually place it. Some scholars place it during the time of Ramses II, which is, in fact, some of the most authoritative scholarship places it at the time of Ramses II, so that would be around 1250 BC. He was a very well-known pharaoh, of course, well-known from the historical records, many monuments. But the actual evidence of the Exodus itself is pretty hard to find. It's primarily known through the pages of the Bible, but there are a lot of things in the Bible which line up with different elements of the Exodus story. So, for example, the name Moses itself is actually an Egyptian name, Mose, and we know that name from Egyptian monuments.
Wow.
It's not Moses himself, the yes. biblical Moses, but that name, for example, is very well known. And there are other names, place names in the Bible related to the Exodus account, which again we can identify on the ground, linguistically correlate on the ground with actual places. So, the root of the Exodus is still a matter of discussion among scholars. Of course, even whether it was Mount Sinai, as per the biblical account, is again questioned. One of the key points I think people need to understand is that the Red Sea, our own translation normally translates the words for Red Sea as Red Sea, and we think of that great body of water between Egypt and the Sinai. But in fact, recent archaeological work, and especially geophysical prospection in the region of the Sinai, shows that it was more likely that the Exodus took place across a shallow series of lakes.
Wow.
Goes with the translation of the Hebrew of Reed Sea as opposed to Red Sea.
Wow.
So you have to imagine it.
No, but that's exciting, you see. And I found myself getting really quite excited as I went up and down the time chain in this chronological exhibition, just trying to place things with what I understood about the Old Testament. And it must be like that for you. Out of your mind with excitement about these new discoveries, for instance?
Oh, look, always. And look, I think I devoured every single story that I could put my hands on about these stories and tried to sort of look at the photographs and look at what evidence did the photographs show. And what really excited me about one of these discoveries was the one of the from Upper Egypt in the region of Luxor, where the excavations took place at the tomb of a man called Musahat from the New Kingdom. So again, the period of around 1450 BC, just before the time of Ramses II. And because we've been working in that exact same mountain with Macquarie University. I've worked on four tombs in that nearby vicinity. And so I looked at that and I thought, oh my gosh, why haven't we found, all those mummies in our tombs? But of course, they're all very different. There's various states of preservation. This was the one the Egyptians discovered was very, very well preserved with the mummies and the coffins and the statues and so forth. Mm. Whereas the things that we've discovered are not quite as well preserved. But we've had some very, very interesting material. We found a lot of mummies, coffins, fragments of coffins. We find a lot of evidence of the original burial equipment of the tomb owners, who are usually very high officials. And of course, there's quite a significant significant amount of early Christian settlement material in the area that we're working in, which is proving very, very interesting. So, it's a fabulous discovery, this new one in Luxor. These mummies that were found in the site of Minya, with the 17 Greco-Roman mummies, again, you know, there's obviously a fair bit of research that needs to take place on those to tell us more about the individuals concerned. But, you know, it's always intensely fascinating, and I can understand why the Egyptians are busy trying to get this out, because yes, they're clearly attempting to try and improve the tourism situation.
Yes, they are. Well, thank you so much. It's always good to talk to you, Karen. I hope we can do so again.
Thanks, Stephen.
Go to any museum that you can find. They've got a fabulous collection at Sydney University, for instance. Just go and investigate the culture and think through the minds of those people and how they were making sense of their world. And then if you're a Christian, project ahead, you know, couple of thousand years, and project ahead to the time when Jesus arrives in the midst of this Roman outpost and starts to do something that's so contrary to the understandings of the day about what God would be like. And then realize that he's the pivot point of all history, because Western civilization actually expands out from that very point. And just to see and understand the change of culture that's taken place because of God's intervention in the world through Jesus and what that means to us, that in itself is an amazing revelation. And I'm certainly of the school that says the more we find, the more we get to point to God's purpose. So these new discoveries may indeed help us to unlock more of the rich story of some of the Old Testament people. Good stuff.